I come back from India, and I was very weird. I had a beard, and I wore a dress, and I was barefoot, and I was a yogi, and I weighed 140 pounds, and I was all ribs, and I stood in my head all the time. I got this kind of reputation up there in this cabin behind my father's farm of being this kind of weird person. And one day, this woman came to see me in a Buick. You know what a Buick represents. And she came to see me in a Buick, and she had on white gloves and a black patent leather purse. And she was the wife of one of the leading business person in the town. It's a town of 6,000 people. And she came up to my room, and I thought, how really unusual. She couldn't sit cross-legged because she had a very narrow skirt on, and I got her a chair, and she sat down, and she said, I've been hearing about you from your father, and because my father was friends with her husband, and they were all hanging out together, being important. And she said, I just felt that you'd understand. I said, what is it that I'm to understand? She said, well, she said, about 12 years ago, one day, something happened in my consciousness, and I was suddenly on another plane of consciousness, and I met this being who I fell in love with. And we entered into a relationship. The predicament was that on this plane, I was already married and with children. So I have to tell you that for 12 years, I have been living on two planes of consciousness. And every time my husband leaves for work in the morning, I go into this other plane and make love with this being. And then we separate in time for my husband to come home. She says, you know, there was nobody in town I could tell that to. You could imagine in a town in New Hampshire of 6,000 people. She'd be out at the funny farm. But, I mean, only some of you think that's weird. Some of you think are thinking he thinks that's weird. Well, when that thing happened to me and I saw the relative nature of my reality that I had been in, and there were these other planes of consciousness, it was interesting. William James, the American psychologist, has said, you know, 100 or 80 years before, he had said, our normal waking consciousness is but one type of consciousness, whilst all about it, parted from it by the filmiest of veils, there lie other types of consciousness. We may spend our entire life without knowing of their existence, but apply the requisite stimulus, and there they all are in their fullness. They've always been there. Whatever their meaning, they forbid our premature closing of our accounts with reality. And William James Hall was the hall I got thrown out of at Harvard. That's fun. Certain dark humor. So once I saw that there were relative planes of reality, that there were other planes of reality that I existed on, and that I was as real as I was on this plane, it didn't make this plane irrelevant. It just made it relatively real, while previously it had been absolutely real. Previously, my father would say, Richard, come down to reality. I'm sure you all know what that means. It means learn your zip code, get your, you know, pay your taxes, get your act together. Change your oil, do your laundry. Do the dishes, for God's sake. Make your bed, do something. Because he saw me out in La La Land. And I saw him as trapped in a reality. And because I had been so trapped for so long, I pushed against that reality, and I became a renunciate. A renunciate, basically, is a traditional practice of saying, that scene has got me so trapped that the best way I can get free of it is getting free of it, getting away from it for a while, until I establish myself in these other planes of consciousness, so that then I can come back and be with these things without being trapped in them. But they're too strong. If I'm busy, caught in my sexual identity, and I walk into a major city or open a magazine or look at television in which everything is fanning that identity as a sexual entity because it's a marketable commodity, it is very hard for me to awaken to that part of my identity that has nothing whatsoever to do with that without thinking you're repressing something. Do you hear that issue? And so I was a renunciate for many years. And I kid about it. I say what I ended up in is what's called the horny celibate syndrome. Sort of like you're busy not having sex. You know, it's not like it's not like sex disappeared or food or anything else. It's just you're busy not doing it, which is a deep attachment. Turns out, for those of us that have dieted or given up smoking. I mean, some people have their major social identity as somebody that gave up smoking. Or an AA. Who are you? I'm an ex-alcoholic. No, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a recovering alcoholic. Excuse me. I get my language right. So I found that even when I got high, and I got really high, that when I got high, there was still fear, and the fear was that I'd come down. And that permeated my high. It was there, no matter how high I got, it was always there that I could come down. Because I was still in dualism, and I was still in the polarity between high and low. I was trying to get high all the time and push away the low. I was pushing, I can't go to the cities, they bring me down. That expression, it brings me down. I used it all the time. Brings me down, I can't go there. I don't want to be with my family, they bring me down. Because they have a definition of reality that isn't the one that I want to espouse at this moment. And I'm very vulnerable to being trapped by them, so I got to push them away. But I finally realize around the mid-70s, that if I'm pushing anything away, it's got me. And the game is to become free, not to get high, because high is still a place where there's fear, and it's only when you're free that you're not frightened. What would you be frightened of? So, that has basically led me in two directions. This isn't a lecture I plan to give, but it never is. I just plan to give lectures to allay my anxiety. See, I've got notes. I mean, you're missing a really great lecture. It's just that's not the one you're getting. So it took me in two directions. One was that I made an about turn, and instead of pushing away the world, I started to engage the world as a curriculum for awakening. That's a major flip around. It happened through my disembodied friend Emmanuel. I'm sure some of you have read the Emmanuel books. And at one point I said to Emmanuel, who speaks through this woman, Pat Rodegast, and he's like an uncle, he's like a spiritual uncle, and I said to him, Emmanuel, what am I doing on earth? Who's made this terrible error? I'm obviously much too pure to be here among all these people. And he said, Ram Dass, you're in school, why don't you try taking the curriculum? And that had been said to me enough times in different ways. Alan Watts said, Ram Dass, why are you so attached to emptiness? Why don't you enjoy form more? And I realized that I was afraid of form because I had been trapped in form for so long and form had been so constricting. So I turned around and I looked at my life as my curriculum. I saw that basically the whole game was to become free. That was it. And that only if you were free could you free another. So out of compassion, if you really wanted to free people from suffering, the first thing you had to do was become free. But of course you couldn't wait till you were free to help. But you got to realize that even your helping is digging the hole deeper most of the time because you're still somebody helping. So they become helped. And you just define new roles. So I turned around and I looked at my life and I saw a variety of different forms that were my unique expression. They were my karma unfolding. They were the unique form of incarnation. I saw that I had a family that was in a certain state of affairs and Dad was old and he needed some support. And that I was a son and that was a part to play within that dance. And that I was the one that didn't have family or was stable enough so that I could really help and so. And then I saw I was part of a community. I was part of a religion. I mean, a genetic religion and social religions. I was part of a nation state. I was part of ecosystems, biotic communities. I mean, it went on and on and on. I mean, I was just making a list of all the different group identities that I have had in the past, like, little while. Oh, you're a party of two? Would you step this way? See, there I'm a party of two. Would all the passengers please attend to the following announcement? I'm a passenger. Before I ring this up, is there anything else you need? I'm a customer. All the members will have a meeting. I'm a member. The board will come to order. I'm a member of a board. Oh, it's good you've come to Israel. Now you can come home. I'm a Jew. You men don't understand us. I'm a man. Sir, do you have your passports so that you can get into Japan tomorrow? I'm an American. Now, I am also, although I didn't psychologically experience these as often, I am a biped, a homo sapien, I am living, a member of the living group, I am part of Gaia, a part of the earth consciousness, I am part of the cosmos, and that's only the beginning. I can give you lots more. I own an MG, so I'm part of the MG owners club. I'm old, so I'm part of the AARP. I just looked around and I saw this incredible web of social identities. And I saw how I had been treating those in my zeal to get high as if they were all impediments. And yet they were the web that gave meaning to my incarnation. Does that come through? Am I losing? No. The ones that I'm losing don't even hear me ask, I guess. Just be happy. So part of me did one thing, which was dive into life. Dive into the web of it all. And start to honor what it meant to be part of a participatory democracy and participate in the fact that I was somebody that worked with dying people for 20 years. That gave me a certain license, and also that I've had a bisexual background, so that the fact that AIDS and dying were coming together had a certain role for me to play within that community. Okay? And the fact that I was part of a world citizenship, so I was in Guatemala and Nepal and India. and that I was part of a family, so I took care of Dad for the 10 years until he died. And that I had to figure out what it meant that I had been genetically born Jewish, and how did that jive with the rest of it, and that's led me to a whole set of steps. The most recent was a week with the Hasids in the Old City in Jerusalem. So I can be a good Buju or Hindu or Christ-Jew or whatever I am, Jubu. So part of it was to come into the bathtub of life. That was part of it. But if that were all that happened, I would probably sink back down into it, and pretty soon it would overwhelm me, and I'd go into denial and all the stuff you do to live within it as if it's solid and real. But simultaneously, I had all my spiritual practices. Practices that were focused on helping me enter into other planes of consciousness and integrate them into my life. That is, when I hold these beads, for example, worry beads, mala, rosary, whatever you want to call them, they are a device for me to remember to live on more than one plane of consciousness simultaneously so I don't get trapped. Example, I'm at the grocery store at the checkout counter. It's 6:15 in the evening. I am hungry and I am tired. I have read the Inquirer the last time I was in. There are three people ahead of me, all with huge, huge grocery wagons, chock full. The woman whose order has just been processed, when she is told that it's going to be $122, she starts to rummage in her purse for her checkbook, which she then has to write and fill out the upper part while we all wait. And I can feel myself contracting. I can just feel myself full of righteous self-pity, full of indignation, full of all that stuff. You know that stuff? I mean, you must have had feelings of that stuff. Why isn't the dinner hot? Why? I have a right. And I was just contracting, see, into righteous indignation with those looks you exchange with everybody else, which is a total, you know. When I feel the bead in my finger and I hear the Ram, which is just another name of, hey, baby, you're getting caught. If you can hear this, this one isn't the same one as that. I just Ramize it all. I just turn it into something else. It's all a form. It's a dance. It's play. It's my uptightness is part of the dance. It's part of the dance along with her being the perfect teacher. I mean, if my guru came along, what form would he come? Why not at a woman at a checkout stand looking at her for her checkbook? I mean, it got me. What more could you ask in a teaching if you wanted to get free? Because the only things that get you are where you have a stash of clinging mind. That's all it gets you. If you don't have any stash, you don't get got. So I have these devices for, like, I sit down to a meal and then I bless the meal. And the blessing of the meal is really connecting to the domain where this all means something different. And as I do that, the idea of me eating changes its nature from, do I want the rice first or shall I start with the broccoli? Or let's put the pepper on. I like pepper. Quick, let's get done with grace so I can get pepper. But then I've trained myself to, wait, slow down a bit, catch it. And then I go into the grace, and then who could care, pepper, no pepper, awesome. Then I enjoy it with pepper. It's like shifting the game of life from a set of need-defined reality to a celebratory form that doesn't come out of need. It's like turning life into a celebration with all of its stuff, all of its stuff. So let's say I sit down to meditate. People say, oh my God, meditate. I don't meditate, or I do meditate, or I don't meditate enough. I love people come and say, hi, I love meeting you. I just don't meditate enough. What's enough and who cares? You know, what is that about? What are they doing? They're using meditation as a way to do themselves in. Another way to put yourself down, I don't meditate enough. What else don't you do enough of? Well, that's the only one I can talk about. Because the reason you meditate is because you see that the thing that is trapping you in this reality that is making you not happy, this separateness, this entrapment of a certain set of models, is the mind. You begin to see you are a prisoner of your own mind, and that your mind is defining what everything else is. And you're only seeing through the filter of your own perceptual apparatus. So you don't know what's out here. You have no idea who I am. You're just seeing the projections of your mind. So somebody comes up and says, oh, Ram Dass, thank you. See, that's the role when I'm supposed to go, yes. Somebody says, hi, Dick. I'm supposed to say, hi. And what I do is I walk down the street experiencing, because I don't care who I am. It's not interesting at all to me. And what I experience is everybody's projections of who I must be. Everybody. I mean, you don't even know them. Just walk down the street in the subway. You're somebody who's an irritant, a potential irritant, who might rip off my license. Anything. Guard your credit cards. Would you trust that man? Or he's bald. Wouldn't you hate to get a mustache? Wouldn't you hate to kiss that? Just feel the projections of mine. And you begin to see what web you have been caught in when your mind is quiet enough so you're not feeding the web all the time. So I sit back and I start to follow my breath, which is a real idiot game. Just breathing in, breathing out. You don't have to be a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Jew or a Christian or an Islamic. You just follow your breath. I mean, everybody's got a breath. Just follow it. It's what the game is you pick one point to focus on and then let all the rest of the thoughts and sensations become like the petals around the center of the flower, which is the breath, and keep coming back to the breath and back to the breath and back to the breath so that the thoughts lose their power to define reality. Doesn't mean you're not going to have any mind left. It means you're not going to be trapped by your thoughts. As what they say in the East is that the intellect is a beautiful servant and a lousy master. And if you think your analytic mind is who you are, I am my thoughts, then you are living in a prison cell of your own mind. And the whole issue of freedom is escaping from that. Not to not live in it, but to live in it without being trapped by it. That's all. Simple as that. So you sit and you follow your breath. Breathe in, you breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out. Try it just for about 15 seconds. You don't have to look meditative. Don't get up. Just try following your breath. Might help if you follow it either at some point, like at the tip of your nose or in your abdomen or something, just going up and down. No big deal. Don't change it. Just follow it. And every time any thought arises or sensation, notice it and then go back to the breath. Each time your awareness is drawn away from the breath to a thought or a sensation, to a memory or a plan, to a sensation in your leg or a sound in the room, notice that it has gone away from the breath and bring it back to the breath. Now, you don't have to keep your eyes closed to do this. Try opening your eyes, but keep the breath, the focus. So you probably can't look out your eyes, but you'll see everything anyway. But don't look, because you're following your breath. But don't turn anything off either. Let it all be there. Don't be busy not seeing or not thinking. Okay, that was just a little teeny experiment. But now imagine doing that, as I have, say for 17 hours a day for 2 months. Just that. Just that. And just think about it for a second. You just did maybe 2 minutes. How about 17 hours a day? You're sitting in a cell in a monastery in Burma. And you have nothing to read and nobody to talk to and nowhere to go. Because you really want to get behind your own thoughts. You really want to free your awareness from the entrapment thought. And you're surrounded by all these teachers. And they supposedly help you do that. They do, most of them. So that a teacher will say, you see the teacher for about 5 minutes a day, and you report exciting events. Like last evening at 7, I was following my breath when I became aware of a bird. Well, what did you do? I noted it as bird, and I noted it as listening, and then I went back to my breath, and that's a great event. And then he says something like, did you notice the bird on an in-breath or an out-breath? I say, I didn't notice, he said. He said, would you try to be more precise? Think, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into? It's just going to trap your mind and trap you and trap you and trap you until you finally give up and your awareness stays with your breath. And instead of being pushing against the breath, every time a thought arises, it just arises, and then you go back to your breath. And that's the beginning of the next stage of the process, in which your awareness becomes like a laser that can start to penetrate into the universe more deeply. This is all very mechanical stuff. This is not mystical. See, Buddha said, I'm not forming a religion. Don't take my word for anything. Go experience it yourself. This is very simple stuff. You can do it. You can have the experience. Okay, that's a method. Let me read you are we okay? The planes of consciousness, one of our problems of this group of us is that there is a lot of confusion about planes of consciousness because there are lots of different planes of consciousness. Now, what spiritual has come to mean is anything that isn't in the physical or the psychological. We call it spiritual. But within the spiritual, there are, first of all, within the psychological, there are many gradations of planes of consciousness. Like when you're 12 to 14 years old, you're capable of being in the rational mind. Most aren't, but you could be. And that's like the fourth stage in the Piaget developmental sequences. And then Maslow comes along with self-actualization, and you get to the fifth plane, which is where you integrate everything, your body and mind and all that. That's all still separate entity-ness, psychological entity. It's me. Self-actualized being. And then you flip into another plane of consciousness, which is like shifting a channel. And the next two channels, which are often called the subtle or the psychic, I'm using Ken Wilber's descriptions now. Those of you that know Ken's taxonomy, it's very useful. He's collated people like Piaget and Buddha and Ramakrishna and Freud and behaviorism. It gives you a list of. The next two planes are the planes of the soul. They're the planes where you are still a separate entity, but you are no longer a physical separate entity. You are the separate entity that incarnated, but you are not the incarnation. That's now two other levels of being. So I look in your eyes and I say, are you in there? And you say, yeah. Are you in there? And I say, yeah. And I say, how did you get into that one? And we see each other as packaged within bodies, personalities, existential stuff, storylines. And we meet as fellow souls, and we sense that we know each other as souls, even though we're meeting for the first time as bodies or incarnates. And the souls are really something like psychic DNA codes. They're really, it's because the next two planes after that is where what we often talk about rather lightly, I think, as unity. As the place where you merge into God, where there is only one thing, which you can get at through physics or through now, through chemistry, anywhere. You can realize that the basic stuff of the universe is one thing. You can call it whatever you want to call it. People call it energy. People call it Prakriti, people call it the mother, people call it, I mean, there are lots and lots of systems for describing the one. It's where all form is still form, but it's not differentiated form. And you and I exist on that plane as well as these planes where we're separate personalities and when we're where we're soul. And then there is one more plane. It's not really a plane. It's the ground in which it all exists. It's the awareness. It's the emptiness. It's the unmanifest. It isn't separate from. It's like looking at the sky. It's a great image. Look at the sky. Imagine the sky. And think of its vastness, its unendingness. It's got nowhere to go. It's not doing anything. The sky isn't coming and it isn't going. And the sky isn't growing old, and the sky is just the sky. And now see the sky as a mirror of your own awareness. And realize that the deepest part of who you are when you say, I, not me, but I see, I know, I am, basically that I ultimately is that awareness. And it has nothing to do with you. And that was the Buddha's second wise moment about that, which was the issue of not only anatta, that everything's changing, but anicca. There is basically nobody there. There's no separate entity that is solid. You are just patterns of thought forms. You are patterns of energy. All things are changing. All things are energy in redistribution. Things including your thoughts about who you are. So that your thought of who you are isn't who you are. So you're not who you thought you were. And what this forces you, if your mind hasn't absolutely been just given up at this point, and I don't blame you if it has, but I couldn't resist just taking you into these realms of speculation, because this is as close to the edge of the stuff that is real for me as I can find. Is that one of the, what you cultivate is awareness. Then you understand something like the line from the Tao Te Ching that says, one does nothing, and nothing is left undone. You're beginning to understand that you're living on more than one plane of consciousness at any one moment. You're flickering between planes. Because that plane of awareness has no form to it. It's not in time, it's not in space. Anything in time and space is form. Anything in form is changing. You can't stand there, you're going to be frightened, because the change means you're going to cease to exist. But you didn't exist in the first place. You just thought you existed. Or you exist as one of, it exists, presence exists, and we are it. And in this sense, this whole game of me talking to you is a hype. There's no you and there's no me. It's talking to itself. There's only one of it, and it's actually silent. Now, how mad to say that a part of us does not exist. That's the predicament. How peaceful are you with acknowledging that the place, the root balance for your whole existence is your non-existence? And that those are both part and parcel of the same thing when they say in Hindu Buddhism, nirvana and samsara are one. Okay, here's two quotes from Ananda Maima. Ananda Maima is a woman that was one of the greatest saints that I have ever been privileged to know. She had millions and millions of devotees in India. And this first one is a little bit like Mother Teresa, but it's coming from this Hindu woman. This is one plane of existence. This is the plane where she is seeing everybody, all forms. She's in the soul level. She's seeing the beloved. She's seeing the other as beloved. She said, "This body has lived with father, mother, husband, and all. This body has served the husband, so you may call it a wife. It has prepared dishes for all, so you may call it a cook. It has done all sorts of scrubbing and menial work, so you may call it a servant. But if you look at the thing from another standpoint, you will realize that this body has served none but God," meaning the awakening to the One. "For when I serve my father, mother, husband, and others, I simply considered them as different manifestations of the One and served them as such. When I sat down to prepare food, I did so as if it were a ritual. For the food cooked was, after all, meant for God. Whatever I did in a spirit of divine service. Hence, I was not quite worldly, though always engaged in household affairs. I had but one ideal, to serve all as God, to do everything for the sake of God." Now, let me just share with you one other paragraph from her, of that she's spoken, that is from a whole other plane of existence. And with high beings, that's the tricky part about, like, the difference between the Jesus words and the Christ words. These are planes of consciousness that are speaking from different places. In this case, she is speaking about the quality of resting in that which is beyond space and time, which is beyond form. At this point, Paramahansa Yogananda, who was no slouch as a saint himself, he asked Ananda Maima to tell him something about her life. "Father, there is little to tell," she said. "My consciousness has never associated itself with this temporary body. Before I came on this earth, Father, I was the same. I grew into womanhood, but still, I was the same. When the family in which I had been born made arrangements to have this body married, I was the same. And Father, in front of you now, I am the same. Even afterwards, though the dance of creation changes around me in the hall of eternity, I shall be the same." Can you find that place in yourself? Can you find that presence that has nothing to do with time or space or sickness or health or life or death or coming or going or taxes or salaries or anything, sad or happy. It has all of it in it, but like the sky, the clouds and the plains and all of it, they don't change the sky. The sky is the sky. And for me, what I have found out, because that's the other place that I have gone, when I realized my predicament, I did two things. One, I came in to honor my incarnation, all the parts I have to play in life, to be, as Christ said, in the world but not of the world, in it but not trapped in it. And the other thing I did was kept cultivating and cultivating, resting in the emptiness of awareness. And at first, these are sequential. You get high, you come down. You get high, you come down. But over time, the art form is to live in the forms simultaneously, to live in the planes of consciousness simultaneously. So that when I look at you, you are the beloved, and you also don't exist, and you are also a man or a woman at the Upsychia conference in Orlando. And no one of those planes was sacrificed for the other. They're all present, including the empty ground in which it all exists. Now, you've got to understand that that empty ground has no fear whatsoever in it. I really am pushing you. I know, and I realize how tough you all are. But, you know, it's so rare we can do this. So if you have to suffer a little, just suffer. It's okay. Don't get angry. Because it's too good to stop. It's not my ego. It's just too rich an opportunity to share this very subtle stuff. We don't get these opportunities too often, and I really want to honor you, Psychia, for allowing us to be together this way.